All right, this is the same presentation that we did this morning, so if you think you're going to get something new, you're not. I mean, that would mean me doing another lesson plan, you know, and I got this all figured out, so I don't intend to do it over. Let me just introduce myself. My name is Peter Pappas. I'm a senior consultant with the International Center. 25 years as a high school teacher, social studies, little time teacher on special assignment, then 5 years as an assistant superintendent for instruction. Sort of a strange career path. Recently retired from my day job. I've got my website, peterpappas.com. The address is one you might want to jot down. I get on average about 1,100 or 1,200 visitors, not hits, but visitors daily. And they are averaging about 8 or 9 minutes there, and they seem to be finding lots of things that they like. So I suggest that you might want to give it a try. For example, I've been doing a lot of work for the International Center with districts across the country on content reading strategies. I've got some material there you can access. I've got a couple short presentations you can look at, one for struggling readers, one for high-performing readers. And someone suggested that I tape this, so I'm taping this talk, so this will be online too, if you don't feel like taking notes. So, trying to find lots of ways to get information out to you. Here's our agenda, and I want to stress, and I didn't make this point in the first session, but my PowerPoint for this session begins on page 18 of the Focus on Instruction. There's another one in there that's actually yesterday's PowerPoint, which looks a little bit similar. So make sure you're starting on page 18. I'll be making some brief comments about learning in the 21st century, really focusing in on rigor and relevance and learning strategies, focusing in on three different strategies, defining, summarizing, comparing. We take a break. Then we'll have the folks from Kennesaw Mountain High School here, and they'll be sharing, I think, some excellent examples of what a model school is doing with a focus on instruction. And then you'll be pleased to know you're the only group that's getting another break. That's right, two breaks, because it's the afternoon. We're getting a little tired. And we'll come back for Q&A. So if you don't want Q&A, you just break and you're broke and you're gone. And if you if you want Q&A, come on back. There are some index cards at your tables, and if you jot down some questions and bring them up here at the end of the first break or during the first break, we're going to go through them and see which ones we know the answers to, and then we'll comment on them later during the Q&A. Now, a point I'd really like to emphasize is these essential questions. And the order of them is highly significant. In other words, you really need to look at the first question before you look at the second question. And the whole purpose, I think, that you have here at the symposium is to try and go back with at least the start of a plan. And our group here today, the folks at Kennesaw Mountain and myself, we are really here to promote the idea that somewhere in that plan, you make provision for really getting folks together on what teaching and learning is going to look like in your building. And that really needs to precede all the structural and procedural things, because they should all be done to really support that vision. Now, I'd like to just focus a little bit more closely at what that means. First of all, we'll be looking at common instructional strategies in a student-centered classroom. And we had a lot of questions in the first session about kind of the challenges of a student-centered classroom. And we're really going to try and help you understand how to move your teachers, at least with some level of comfort, to that, knowing that it is a challenge. It's sort of not the way most of us were taught, and in many cases not the way we were trained to teach. The second point I'd like to make is that this is really not just about a rigorous and relevant classroom, it's about a rigorous and relevant school community. In other words, you cannot simply expect teachers to be utilizing this when you then bring them into a faculty meeting and read memos to them, okay? If all you're going to do with your parents is come in and tell them what's on the test and kind of just push information to them and not engage them at a rigorous and relevant level, then you're really not going to, I think, feel the full effects of what you can do to really focus your entire school community on student achievement. And the third point I'd like to stress is in the end, it's all about staff development. And many times you're going to have teachers who are going to tell you that they don't believe in a student-centered classroom. It's chaotic or something like that. I often think that we fail to realize that it may be just a question of their own hesitancy as to whether they could manage that situation. And so we really have to provide our teachers with a capacity and an opportunity to grow. And I think that your staff development should look exactly like what you're expecting to see in your classroom. And if you want teachers to differentiate, then you better differentiate their professional development. And I can take it right on down the line. Ultimately, it's all about adding value to student performance, and everyone in your organization, your support staff, all of you should be really focused on that, because that's what we're in the business to do. And I do stress this is partial assembly required. In other words, we are intentionally raising a lot of questions, because to some extent we can't answer them for you. You are going to have to negotiate that answer within the context of the specifics of your environment. So I'm not saying that as a way of getting out of anything. I'm just saying that you can't take Kennesaw Mountain and move it to your school. But you can take the best of what they're doing and be inspired by it, and you can say, what would that look like with our kids? Now, this is actually not my hair. This is another person's hair. No, I got started back in 1970-71, and a few things have changed since then. One of the things that changed is, I guess, the whole logic around whose responsibility it was for kids to learn. Back in 1972, the U.S. Department of Education put out a report that basically said there was very little you could do in the classroom to change student performance, that it really depended on what walked in the door. And that was largely because this was an era of a lot of poverty programs, and they were trying to promote the notion of a war on poverty. Certainly now with NCLB, you see that that's changed around. So by and large, most of us are in a profession that's much different than the one we signed up for. And I think we have to understand that, and we have to know that our teachers feel very stressed by it. And once again, they need the tools to be successful. And the other thing that's changed, which certainly Dr. Daggett spoke at length about yesterday, is information technology, which has dramatically changed the nature of the flow of information in the classroom. It's now both personal and collaborative. What do I mean by that? Well, first of all, kids have become their own researchers, potentially. And they're certainly their own entertainment directors. And if you think about all the media forms that seem to be on the slide, like network television, films, all the big broadcast media, they're all fading because kids today want to select what they want to listen to when they want to see it. So they're going to TiVo what they want to see. They're going to listen on their iPods. And so that's one aspect that we have to be cognizant of. And the other is that that this new digital age also allows people to collaborate, and they're finding each other online, and they're setting up all sorts of collaborative databases. I mean, certainly even Amazon's reviews that people write are in a sense a collaborative database. Wikipedia, if you've heard of that, which is an online encyclopedia that people edit. So the bottom line is it's both personal and collaborative, and yet we need to understand that changes our role in the classroom. We have to help our kids make sense out of all of it. Dr. Daggett spoke yesterday about the Martin Luther King website that was hijacked by the white supremacist group. I mean, we have to give our kids tools to sort through through this, we have to make sure that that kind of collaboration is happening within the context of our buildings. And most importantly, there's an equity issue because we have lots of students who can't afford these toys at home and can't afford these tools. And if we don't provide them in school, they may never get them. Now, I spoke at length about this in a talk up in Toronto recently, which I called Literacy in a Copy-Paste Era. And if you go to my website, there's actually, you can download the talk if you'd like to hear a little bit more of my thoughts in that regard. But it certainly has changed the nature of what literacy means, because it's all about decoding information, evaluating it, sorting it, sharing it, and so forth. And I think that point is brought home in Tom Friedman's new book, The World is Flat, where he points out that this digital technology now means that this digitized information can be moved anywhere in the world, and virtually anyone has access to it and the ability to collaborate. So our students are going to be competing on a global scale. And we want them to be able to function in the way that skilled professionals do. And yet I venture to say that we don't do enough, for example, in our science classes to sort of showcase for students how engineers read or write or think, or in our music courses how composers think about things or reflect on their work. And so we have to do a much better job of revealing what's going on in all these disciplines that we aspire to prepare our students for. Now, I would suggest to you that the rigor and relevance framework is a great starting point, a great jumping off point in terms of looking at how to craft your own vision or your own focus on instruction. The rigor portion of it is based, of course, on Bloom, and that's on the vertical axis. And on the horizontal axis, we have relevance, from moving from the highly sort of scripted, prescribed things that tend to happen in school to the much more fluid, flexible, unrehearsed, spontaneous kind of thinking that most of us have to do in the real world. And I love your clip from Apollo film. They have a wonderful clip that demonstrates that. I'm pointing over to Kennesaw Mountain, by the way. So that's the horizontal. And what we're really trying to do is we're trying to not eliminate quadrant A, because you can't think critically about nothing. I mean, you have to have some information. But to have a much more varied palette of experiences for our students. And I think it's especially important to make them aware of what quadrant we're in and why we're there and why we're sequencing it the way we are. So I wanted to give you a little chance to loosen up after lunch here and to do a little problem solving and something that's somewhat unrehearsed and spontaneous. And so in your binders, if you will turn in the Focus on Instruction section over to page 67 for a moment. Will you do that? And on page 67, you will see kind of a little form sheet that needs to be filled out. It's a little survivor exercise. And this is something I've used in strategic planning with administrators and teachers. And I'm just going to do it very, very quickly here. But I thought you'd find it engaging. It might be something you could modify and use for yourselves. Here's the scenario. Again, it's on page 67 in the binder. We're going to assume it's 10 a.m. in the morning. It's August. You crash-landed in the Sonora Desert in the southwest. The plane you were in is burned. Only the airframe remains. The pilot is dead, and you're not injured. Now, prior to the crash, the pilot could not notify anyone of the problems you were having, and all you know is that you're 70 miles away from a mining camp, you're 65 miles off the flight plan you filed, you know, your intended route, and you're able to salvage 10 items out of the plane prior to the plane burning. Now, I'm going to give you these 10 items, and what I'd like you to do is just jot them down in that little table, and I'd like you to then working by yourselves, and we're going to go kind of quickly, I only take about 10 minutes for this entire exercise, I'd like you to rank them on the basis of 1 to 10, based on what you think is the most important, down to 10, which is the least important, and of course I'm just giving them to you in an arbitrary order, okay? So, the first item is a parachute. Then we have a topographic map of the area. Of course, we have Cher's Greatest Hits, which is a 4-CD set. We have a book entitled Edible Animals of the Desert, a handgun with bullets, a compass. We have some salt tablets. We have an overcoat, a flashlight, and what trip would be complete without 2 liters of vodka? Okay? So we've got 10 items. And I'd like you to first work by yourselves, and hypothetically, if you think that the vodka is the most important item, then you put a 1 there, and then you put, if you think edible animals is the next, or the book is the next most important, you write a 2 there, and so on. And I'd like you to just kind of very quickly, and I just mean this is instantaneous, fast, I'd like you to go through and rank them. Now, of course, you're not going to use the ranks that I did. And then when you're done doing them as an individual, just pick somebody nearby and see if you can start to agree on a list. Okay? And my watch says 1:30, and I want to have this whole thing done in about 8 minutes. So you get started quickly. Again, you're going to rank them on your own, 1 to 10, 1's the most important, and then very quickly work with somebody else to see if you can collaborate on a score. Survival experts. This is not my own little fantasy as to what works. Let me pose a couple questions to you, and I want you to sort of keep in the back of your mind what this may have to do with the focus on instruction. First of all, what was your primary objective? Now let me ask a real direct question. How many of you are going to hike out? You're going to go to safety. Okay. So what sort of items did you put at the top of your list? Compass. Okay. How many of you are going to go hunt for animals? You need some food. Okay. Anyone going to have a party? They needed vodka. Okay. So let's see what the experts have to say. Now, the first thing about the experts say that the way to survive the situation is to stay put. Yeah. Right? So all of you that that decided to hike out, you're dead. In fact, we could do a little test here. We could see how many superintendents are hiking out. No, you know what's real interesting about leaders? Leaders want to lead people to their death in this exercise. They just want to take, you know, we've got to do something. We've got to go somewhere. Actually, what the experts say is that the best thing is to stay put and be rescued. And with that in mind, item number 1, the Cher CD. Why? It's a mirror. You have 4 reflectors, and this is your most powerful signaling tool. And if you'll be quiet, I'll continue here. Item number 2 is the overcoats, because you want to keep your warm, moist skin away from that dry desert air, because you're going to suck all the moisture out of you. The 3rd is a flashlight, which is a night signaling device. The 4th is the parachute, which is not only shade from the sun, but it's big, it's visible. You can drape it over the wreckage of the plane. The next is the handgun. Now we're starting to get down to the sort of useful, sort of not. You know, the plus side is it is a sound signaling device. The bad part is as you get delirious at the end of the first day, you may shoot one of your traveling companions. Of course, the magnetic compass isn't much use. I mean, it's got a little reflective quality, but the experts say don't try and hike out. The topographic map for the same reason. No point in chasing around gophers for food, because you're going to die of dehydration long before you get hungry. I mean, it really takes a long, long time to starve to death, so you know, I wouldn't worry about that. The vodka, of course, we all know that just dries you out anyway. Sorry, partiers, that's not a good idea. And lastly, the salt tablets, which is kind of a myth that we need to take salt tablets when we might dehydrate. I'm thirsty. I'm going to get a drink. Now, if you intend on using this with another group, one of the interesting things to do is to get into the next. Oh my God, it's gone. Okay, well I'll just explain it then. You'll see there's a column 3 and 4, and you can look at the difference between the individual and the expert. Just it's strictly a plus or minus something. You can look at the difference between the group and the expert. You know, you can see if folks did better as individuals or groups. You can talk about group dynamics. There's a lot of things you can do with it. But what interests me the most is I think it's an interesting exercise in defining your goals and trying to understand if your resources are aligned with your goals. And, of course, the point I'm trying to make to you is that if your instructional vision precedes all those structural elements, then in a sense you have to make a decision if you're hiking out or if you're going to wait and be rescued. And maybe the metaphor falls apart there, but you really need to decide what it is you're trying to do before you can allocate your resources. The other sort of interesting subtext I would point out is from an instructional point of view, think about the engagement you have while I'm up here lecturing versus the engagement you have when you're solving a higher order, real world, unpredictable problem, as opposed to just sitting there getting what I'm dishing up. So that's another thought. Now if we go back to our presentation here, you're bright people. I think you see the connection between this exercise and what we need to do as educators. Now unfortunately, the answers to our questions, what our experts have to say, are sometimes divergent, but that's where we need to focus in on data and really start to have some serious discussions about what's working. And just to kind of give you a little example of that, I'd like to point out this engaging the school community. We typically associate the demographics of our students with performance. And I think we all know that there's clearly a correlation there. But as I was working with folks around New York State, I took some data from the Schools Matters website, which is a great, or schoolmatters.com, which is an excellent database of comparative data on districts and schools all the way across the country. And, excuse me just a moment. Get my pointer. On the vertical axis, we have what they're using as a reading and proficiency measurement. On the horizontal axis, free and reduced lunch. And as you begin to sort of pluck in all of the districts around New York State, which is what I did, you'll see very clearly there's a trend line. And as the free and reduced lunch rate goes up, the student performance drops. Okay, so there's clearly a correlation. In fact, these are all the schools in New York plotted on that. Now, I think what's interesting is if you engage your school community in kind of a profound discussion, which is, do you notice that while there's a correlation at any particular income level, like 30% free and reduced lunch, notice we have schools that are performing up here, we have schools that are performing down here. So there's about a 20-point spread or more, even 30-point spread at any level of poverty. And so the real question you have to engage your organization in is to move away from this sort of absolute notion that, well, you know, we've got these low-income kids and, you know, their parents are not supporting us as best they can, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we're sort of stuck with our zip code. And these are the scores we're going to get. You have to look around and benchmark, and I think that's a great thing about the project that's going on here at the center, is to say among schools at 50% poverty or 30% poverty or 40 or 30, what are other schools doing? And I would suggest that it really gets back to focusing in on those factors that impact student performance, and certainly Bob Marzano's done some fine work there. Folks here at the center have done that. I included just a little survey in your binder on page 65, which is a nice little tool to get your faculty perhaps engaged in a conversation about the kinds of instructional factors that might impact student performance, things that they might want to do more of, help them prioritize if they're already doing this practice or not, how they feel it might impact student performance. In other words, you've got to find some ways to begin that conversation in your organization about what's going to impact student performance and what are the instructional practices that we can embrace. Now, I'm going to focus in on three strategies. Now, as I said earlier, I've been going around the country working with districts, usually in one or two-day workshops, trying to share with teachers of all disciplines, kids of all ability levels, how they can really focus in on instructional strategies. And I think what's nice about coming at that basic level of instruction is that it's right where the rubber meets the road, and it's not about just high-performing kids or low-performing kids or any particular subject. And so I'm just going to share a little taste of that with you today, and I've got a lot of reflective questions in there because I want you to go back thinking about the extent to which you've really looked at instruction in your building, especially as you craft your vision for instruction. So the first is defining. And, you know, we begin with just some real basic questions. You know, for example, do you teach defining skills? Now, I don't call this vocabulary because this is about constructing meaning. This is about defining. And it's very easy to, quote, read without constructing meaning. I'll give you an example, and this is in your handout. It's a little nonsense paragraph. But if I asked you to answer question number one, how many goo-boos of puzz balls are there? The answer would be torque. We've all got that answer. No comprehension whatsoever, just a little understanding for word order and some basics. In contrast, this is a nice little short story from Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine in 1950. And we don't have to take all the time to read it now, but it's just dialogue between a couple of people. And there's an enormous amount of inference that goes on between these lines. And so we have the first example with virtually no comprehension. We have this one where you can construct an enormous amount of meaning out of it. And so what you have to really give some thought to is what reading and comprehension really means for your students and for your teachers. Now, as far as teaching defining skills, I think there's two major elements of that. One is really connecting kids with prior knowledge, and we all know that we have kids with great vocabularies and others that don't, and we have kids with very rich academic experiences and others that don't. And so we have to find ways to build more background knowledge, to hook into what they have and expand it. And, of course, that's facilitated by more deeply processing the information, more deeply processing the meanings that the kids are negotiating. I'm just going to quickly share a few things. Again, I do this normally in a much longer session. Certainly, giving students opportunities to wrestle with meanings of words before they get the glossary out. Okay, here's kind of one approach to that. Here's another where perhaps a group of students are going to negotiate a definition prior to pulling out the glossary, and hopefully evolve a better understanding of the word. Giving students an opportunity to compare their preliminary definitions and perhaps explore the different meanings that might emerge, some of the similarities and differences. There's a nice little technique, a list group label. You give them a term, you say, jot down all the words you can think of that you associate with this word, in this case, revolution. And then have them work in groups to cluster these and perhaps label them and start to see some of the dimensions, some of the differing meanings of revolution in different contexts. So just to toss the question out, how is defining taught in your building? Do you have a common set of strategies, or are you just assuming that everyone's doing whatever it is they're doing? And are they in fact teaching defining, or are they just asking kids to get the glossary out? Here's a nice little tool for students to track their progress. They encounter a term. We'll say the term is segregation. The first step is for them to generate their own definition before they go to the dictionary. Then they get the dictionary definition, and then the most important step, you ask them to compare their definition to the dictionary definition, and you find with this student that in defining segregation, they thought of segregation as a time period, you know, like the Roaring Twenties, you know, in the days of segregation. So they really didn't have a complete understanding of the word. You have to give them lots of ways to internalize this vocabulary once you have the right definition out there. Ways to process it, examine it, reflect on it. Lots of non-linguistic models, concept definition maps. I included a bunch in your handout there. There's many, many different ones. I really urge teachers to work with students to develop their own. We've actually put them on book covers, so kids have concept definition maps on their book covers. Well, I'll be talking about text structure models. I mean, have them in front of the kids. So, again, question. Do you use any common ones? First of all, is that common practice? And if so, are they using similar models? Looking at ways to finalize the mastery, asking them to make connections, identify something from their personal life, how their understanding has evolved. It's very essential that we finish this off. Now here's another question. Has your school agreed on some common terms? Or is that just up to each teacher? Back in my former district, East Irondequoit, at our middle school, we developed a Word of the Day project. We didn't teach Latin, but we thought it'd be nice to give them, for example, a Latin root word here, durare, and then for an entire week give a series of words that all are based on that: endure, endurance, durable, duration. And in every class, every teacher used that term that day. So we had 180 days of school, we had 180 terms. Teachers need to have ways to monitor the student acquisition, and at the same time, if it's going to be student-based, kids need to monitor their own progress. Do you have a method of tracking that in your building? Or is that just left to chance? Is that just on the vocabulary quiz, or is there something a little more meaningful? Here's a nice little model where students self-evaluate based on a rubric. And in this case, they might be at level 4, where they have a real nuanced understanding of the term, basic understanding at level 3, and so forth. And then students actually track their understanding. So in this example I gave you about segregation, the student rated themselves a 3. And then, because that was part of Unit 3, they were keeping track of their progress. How many words did they know at a rubric level 3, a 4, a 2, a 1? Giving them some ownership of their acquisition of vocabulary. Bottom line is, we want to move vocabulary away from just a simple knowledge comprehension quadrant A activity out into a much more complete defining exercise, which really puts you in all 4 quadrants, because we're always trying to construct meaning. We'll move on to summarizing, which I call synthesis and judgment. Again, we want kids to summarize. It's very important, but do we teach summarizing? If so, do we have common practices? Do we just expect kids to know how to summarize? I mean, if you say to a kid, summarize it, what's it mean? He looks for the bold headings in the text and copies it down? Have you shared with them the connection between text summaries, visual summaries, discussion summaries? because they all relate. We certainly know it's a powerful instructional tool. Research says that students that go through a summary exercise following a lesson have a much higher rate of content mastery than students that don't. So it works, but what are we doing about it? I think it's important to help students and teachers draw the connection not just with text summaries, but with active listening, which is another summary technique, and to understand that good active listening tools are a good stepping stone, especially for your struggling readers, to text summary tools. So that if we're in conversation in a discussion group, and I say to you, so what you're saying is, that's a direct parallel to something in the text where I say, so what the author is saying is. We all know we have to be better questioners, and teachers sometimes struggle with their questioning techniques. A lot of classroom discussions are like, guess what I'm thinking? Like, well, no, no, that's it, you've got it, and heaven forbid there's any wait time, you know? Come on, Susie, you know, I can always count on you. You've got it, come on, tell me. So we really need to have some staff development that really focuses in on discussion techniques. Because how are our teachers going to model that for kids? How do we expect kids to have good discussion groups if they're not being stimulated by good discussions with their teachers? And over time, you can take those discussion techniques and you can transition them from sort of a teacher-based discussion to a student-based discussion. And again, we've all gone into classrooms and we've seen group work, which is like chaos, and that's why a lot of your teachers do not want to get into the quote, student-centered classroom, because they haven't had the training, they haven't had the skills perhaps to train their students how to work effectively in groups. And there's a whole series of questioning techniques that you can share with your faculty to really help them better understand how to elicit deeper meaning from their students, and over time you will see students begin to mimic that as they have conversations with one another. So another question, do you train your teachers for discussion techniques? Do they use common techniques with your students? What's it mean to be in a group in your building? Is there some expectation? Are there defined roles? Or is it just whatever happens? Now, there's some great techniques for more text-based summaries. You can do a paired reading where student one reads to student two, and student two summarizes, and they go back to the text to clarify. You can sort of augment that by the teacher supplying guiding questions, and maybe in a little discussion group, students are sort of given a list of leading questions to ask. One can play the role of coach, one summarizer. You can have students working in multiple groups to develop text summaries and then get together to collaborate on a collective summary, going back to the text for evidence. Again, there's lots of ways to structure this. The other point that I've worked a lot with teachers is to share with them that visual summaries are a great segue into text summaries, especially for our struggling readers. So I'll just put you through a little bit of one here to kind of wake us up a bit. In this case, we're going to extract some details from some images, but we've actually tied it yet to another level of Bloom, which is evaluation. Because we want to make a choice among four photographs. I'm going to show you four pictures. I'm going to tell you that you are the assignment editor for a magazine, 1930s, back in the U.S., Life magazine. You sent a photographer out to take some pictures of some migrant workers. You can pick one picture to illustrate the article that the writer's written. And we're going to just get over to these pictures. It's going to cycle through these four photographs. So you're extracting information with the purpose of evaluating which photograph you would use to illustrate the article. So I'll let you look at these. It cycles through a couple times. Now, what I would normally do with students is I would put them through the process of telling me why they would pick one photograph over another. But remember, evaluation is based on criteria. So we would need to structure this, and we would need to agree on the criteria for the selection of the photograph. I'd have them develop some sort of graphic organizer. I would then ask them to go back as they were making their selections and look for evidence specifically as to the people, actions, activities, objects that they saw in pictures to support their conclusion. And then I might surprise them by telling them that the actual photograph that was picked was yet this other photograph, which became an icon, called Migrant Mother. And we might then go back and try and understand why this photograph by Dorothea Lange became such an important historic artifact. So, are there common evaluation techniques used in your building? Do kids know what it means to evaluate? Do they understand the use of criteria? Or do they just think evaluate means I like it or I don't? Certainly understanding that text follows patterns and that there are text structures that underlie much of what's being written. So do we give our students strategies for mapping text structures? And in your handout, I provided you with some common text structures here on the left and some of the characteristics of them. And then just a short little illustrative piece on the Olympics, in this case a description with its own text organizer, a comparison with a different text organizer, a passage that's cause and effect, another one that's a problem solution, and yet another one that's about sequence. Think of what would happen if you spent some time training your teachers about text structures and you had a common set of graphic organizers for kids to utilize. Again, trying to move summarization as a learning strategy out of quadrant A, where it typically might just involve comprehension, we'll say, here's the main idea, out into the other quadrants. Finally, comparing. Research has shown it's the single most powerful instructional strategy you can utilize. Typically, it looks like this. The teacher selects what's going to be compared. The teacher takes the items and generates them, the items that are the aspects that are going to be compared. The teacher designs the graphic organizer with this set purpose of the correct item going in the right place. And then students dutifully information file and put everything where it's supposed to go. Now, I ask you, who's done all the thinking? The teacher. The teacher did all the messy work of figuring out what to be compared, what to include in the comparison, what to leave out. That's where all the creative work was. And the student was left just putting things in the right place. You know, getting back to information technology, I mean, we've got all kinds of database tools out there now. We need someone that can design the comparison. So what would happen, for example, if students were given a different type of assignment where they pick the geographic region, they develop the model, they decide what factors, they go get the data, they develop the graphic organizer? Much, much more powerful. We really need to give kids an opportunity to design the comparison and to work in teams to evaluate each other's comparison and to look at how things can be compared in different ways and how comparisons have underlying assumptions. You could start them with something relevant or something that's interesting to them. You might look at quantifying it, especially moving out of the math class and trying to quantify a comparison and look for correlations in social science or social studies or science or music, business, career in tech ed. An even more powerful comparison is a classification, because now you need to begin to develop a system. You need to answer questions like, where do things go? What stays in? What comes out? how do I compare these things? That really demonstrates a much higher level of learning. You can start them with a model like this, where perhaps they have a decision to make, and they have some criteria for evaluation, and they get to pick the criteria. Maybe you give them one of the criteria, they pick the others. They choose some options. Here's this in practical terms. We're going to give them something perhaps interesting to them. Choosing a college, we're going to let them design the system. We're going to let them figure out how to quantify it. I mean, cost is pretty easy. That's a number. But how do you put some of these others into quantifiable form? And, for example, is location as important as cost? I mean, if you can't afford it, who cares where it is, right? So giving them a chance to develop and design and compare one another's systems of classification. So I toss out another question. Are you teaching them ways to compare, evaluate, make decisions? Do you have common strategies, or you just want them to do that? Now, I think the rigor and relevance model is a great jumping-off point for crafting this vision on instruction. I think you can put your students at the center of their learning. You can give them some ownership so they know what they're learning, why, what they can do to contribute. At the same time, you help put teachers in charge of their teaching when they have a common view, a common sense of purpose, and they see that the organization is designed to support that. I think we know we want highly qualified teachers, but they really need explicit instruction and instructional strategies. That's probably not what they learned in their pre-service programs. They need to get in and see one another doing it. They need administrators that can come in and model it. Your administrator better be going through the same training your teacher's going through. And they need a chance to reflect with one another. And I get back to that point about a rigorous and relevant environment. If this isn't an interesting place to be a teacher, it's not going to be an interesting place to be a student. Now, Doug Reeves has a nice little model that I'll just share with you. On the vertical axis, he moves from low scores to high scores on student achievement. On the horizontal, he moves from a low level of understanding as to what improves student performance up to a high level. And he notes that a lot of us are just losing. We're getting low scores, but we don't understand why. We focus on bringing up the scores, which we're trying to get lucky. We're not working on our understanding. The real key is the vertical, to try and understand what improves student performance, craft that into a common vision. Perhaps it's going to take a little while to get there, but eventually we are leading. Again, I remind you there's some central elements for you to focus in on, and that's going to conclude my portion. Now what we're going to do is we're going to take a 15-minute break. There's some snacks that are kind of up that way, and we'll say 25 after, 20 after, we're going to get started back in here with Kennesaw Mountain High School. Thank you all very much.